Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppens.
My name is Kathleen McGowan. And our guest today is Philip Coppens.
Thank you for having me on your show, Kathleen.
Thank you for being on our show, Philip Coppens. Today is the Philip Coppens interview. We have decided that we're going to devote this hour to ancient aliens because Philip's new book, The Ancient Alien Question, has just released. And it's actually available right now on Amazon and on the online bookstores. The bigger bookstores in the United States will be carrying it beginning next week. I think Barnes & Noble is going to have a promotion where it's going to be on the front tables starting November 15th, I'm told. Is that correct?
They are actually trying to rush them to Barnes & Noble to get a special promo out there before the official release date. But yes, once they are all there, so some of Barnes & Nobles across America will have them. Some of them don't have it yet. And then the book is coming back to the front tables just before Christmas. In the 2 weeks leading up to Christmas, it'll be prominently displayed everywhere in the Barnes & Noble's table section.
So The Ancient Alien Question, it's kind of the unofficial companion book to the series, because there isn't an official companion book to the series, correct?
It is correct.
So what have you written? Why have you written it? What's the initial background behind the book? And then we'll talk about some of the controversies, because we love controversies.
Well, the background with the book is this, that Ancient Aliens series is obviously a hit, but there's also a desire by people to go beyond the series, to sit down with material at their own time. By default, Ancient Aliens is an hour each week, four subjects, sometimes three, sometimes four. That is a given. With this book, you can go into a kind of format which you can't get on television, and you can dip in and out of certain material and group it differently as well. So that is one thing which I wanted to do. And I also felt that there wasn't really a book like this out there. There isn't a book which really addresses the question, were we visited or not? There are some books which go into aspects of the question, but quite often they theorize, they put forward theories. Sometimes they are great or grand, not so great in the sense that they're good, and sometimes they focus on minute aspects. And so for the 100 million people across the world who see an episode of Ancient Aliens during that episode's lifetime, what I wanted to do was give people tools and give them space where they could basically think about these things and explore these things into more detail at their own pace, at a book pace as well.
Well, one of the things, I'm going to give away a little bit of a secret here, not really, but the fact is that I'm lucky enough to observe what happens with the tapings of Ancient Aliens, and I have been here while you have answered 8 to 9 hours worth of questions. So as a result, I know that, you know, for every snippet that appears on the air, there is a very, very long answer. There is a lot of explanation. There is so much background and detail that goes into the research on this show. And that's the thing that I really love about it the most. And the reason that I was excited ultimately to be a part of it in season 3 was I have watched the research, the depth, how thorough the participants and the producers and the writers are in getting to this information. So I know how much there is. And with you specifically, of course, I know how much there is, not only because I live with you and I know that you're a walking encyclopedia on this stuff, but because as I watch them tape the show, I watch how long your answers are. So sometimes, you know, it's the nature of television. It becomes a 10-second or 20-second snippet. And I know that there's so much more to it. And sometimes I watch the show and I'm like, oh, I wish they'd let him give the whole explanation or tell the whole story. So what I think is wonderful about this book is it really does that for Ancient Aliens fans. It really gives them the opportunity to see what else is behind that one sentence snippet. Where else can we go with this information? It takes everything so much deeper and really provides all the background research.
Absolutely. And also what the book enables people to do is to go into material where quite often there isn't much visual information. TV, by default, is a visual medium. So you need to give certain things to people to look at while you are doing this explanation. And there are topics where it's really hard. And sometimes, you know, the topics are long. And what you can do in a book is basically weave threads, like, you know, like, one of the things which I try to do, which people will get is Leopoldo Batres is the head of archaeology at the Teotihuacan excavation. And his name comes up in two instances. One, when it comes to the mica temple and how he's selling mica basically on the black market, from Teotihuacan. And why there is mica in Teotihuacan is a very big and interesting question, which the Ancient Alien, series has posed on television, but they didn't go to that name of Leopoldo Batres. Now, when it comes to crystal skulls, some of them have been traced back to Eugene Boban and that horrible, wretched woman of the Smithsonian called Jane Walsh. she says that, you know, he basically sold crystal skulls which he got from Germany. And, well, you know, what do we know about Boban? Well, Boban didn't have any connection with Germany whatsoever. She's completely made that up. But Boban was a force in the Mexican antique market. And guess what he did? Who was amongst his friends? It's Batres, Leopoldo Batres, who we know sells archaeological things from his own excavations on the black market. And so a more logical conclusion is that some of these skulls came from Batres, and that he was selling them on through Boban, and that Boban sold them on to the British Museum and the Paris Trocadero. So all of these things are more logical, and this is something which you can do in a book, because people will remember that name. You know, a name like Leopoldo Batres stands out. And you can do that in a series of Ancient Aliens if you really were to make it into Batres as the bad guy, which is not the format, you know, which Ancient Aliens, the series, is known for. So certain things you can do in print, which you can't do basically on television. And what I always try to do, and which I think I managed with the 2012 DVD, because I had full control over that, is that when people watch it again, they have, you know, like on the second viewing, they have a new layer of kind of like reading. And I think I did this with the Ancient Alien question as well. There will be, if you are, you know, wanting to reread the book, that there is a second layer there of material which will begin to pop up or pop out, so to speak, upon second reading.
Well, and some of this material is fairly complex, like the circumstance that you just talked about. You know, you can't really handle that in a TV show, but it is complicated, but it's also important. A lot of these backstories about what's happening in these worlds of archaeology really, really matter to this subject, because you have to get, I think it's critical that readers, people who are really interested in the subject, understand what you're up against when it comes to, you know, trying to wade through this evidence, and how obstructive and dishonest the scientific community has been. Let's go back to Jane Walsh for a minute. I mean, Jane Walsh is the Cruella de Vil of the crystal skull world. And, you know, I think actually Cruella de Vil has more integrity, because at least she's honest about what her intentions are. People who are listening to this who don't know who Jane Walsh is and the crimes against the truth that have been committed on her watch, can you just give them a little bit of a background about Jane? Because I think that she's archetypal in this field of what is wrong and why it is so difficult to come to real conclusions and to prove anything, because you have people like this in power.
Yes, absolutely. You know, she is a woman who works for the Smithsonian, and at one point somebody dropped off a clearly modern, weird-looking crystal skull at the Smithsonian and said, "Here, this is for you guys." And it ended up in her, not necessarily her possession, but it came to her attention, and she began to research this thing. And then she realized that she had found an inroad that nobody else in the scientific establishment had really tackled crystal skulls. And what the Smithsonian do, not just on this aspect, but people who are interested in ancient America, Frank Joseph, to some extent, when we interviewed him more than a year ago on this subject, went into it a bit. But specifically people who are into ancient American history, pre-Columbian history, they will tell you that the Smithsonian are basically in the business of covering things up about the truth about where ancient America comes from. Artifacts which completely disappear. And, you know, they always hold on to the most boring, mundane stuff. But the thing which is controversial is like, oops, sorry, we don't know where that went. And so she falls in this category. So she zoomed in onto the crystal skulls. She has been vociferously proclaiming that all of these crystal skulls come from a German little town where they were working in with crystals at the end of the 19th century. And she has never, ever, 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 ever presented any evidence whatsoever that any crystal skull could potentially have come from there. But she gets away with it because she, you know, she can write on the Smithsonian website. She gets access to certain magazines as a result of her being connected to the Smithsonian. And she clearly, whenever there is in this outdated format of some TV shows, which specifically the National Geographic Channel seems to still adhere to, this tit for tat. Somebody says something. Oh, let's put somebody else in there and who says something else. And she will be that voice, who says something else. She discards large amounts of archaeological evidence. You know, she is just typical. In the 20 plus or so radio interviews on the ancient alien question, which I've done, I also use the example of Joseph Davidovich, who is a master in his field. He's the father of a science. It's a long story, but basically when he was trying to explain certain things to Egyptologists, he was told flat in his face that he was a idiot. And that everybody could see that the science of geopolymers, you know, like he was basically told that the pyramid wasn't made from cement. Now, Davidovich has got a curriculum vitae which is longer than most books. And for an Egyptologist to say he's an idiot is at the very least disrespectful. But these are the things which are going on in archaeology. And I think they're getting away with it. You know, they're lazy bastards. Let's call it what they are. A statistic on Italian archaeology says that of all the work which has been archaeologically excavated, 80% has never been written up. So basically an archaeologist goes to a dig certain things up, comes away with some artifacts, and then in 80% of the cases doesn't do anything with it whatsoever. Amongst the 20% are scientific publications which take decades before they are actually being published. Now, name me one profession in the world where you can get away with that.
Right.
And they pretend as if everything is fine. You know, and they get away with it at this moment in time because politicians and the financial sector is far more, in far more serious problems than the academic circle when it comes to big problems. But where science does become controversial, when it comes to climate science, people have this mistaken belief that, oh, you know, like science is done properly and anything which goes against this, you know, there will be clear traces to the fact that this is climate deniers, climate change deniers, that they're in the pockets of the big oil companies. Well, guess what? The big oil companies are quite in favor of being shown that there is climate change going on because they get over $100 million per year by the government in America which they kind of, you know, have gotten because they said, well, if we want to get cleaner, you know, we need to have grants for this to do research into how possibly we can do this. And the American government has said, fine, here's a few hundred million each year. So they're happy with reports which says that climate change is real because they get extra millions, hundreds of millions each year for which they really have to do very little. But what climate science is endemic, it's exactly what is wrong with other circles of science. And archaeology is one of them where we are really confronted with a science, who doesn't want to do anything. Because Ancient Aliens is so popular, you will read blogs on the internet from archaeology professors who very much go like, you know, guess what just happened today? An archaeology student has been watching Ancient Aliens and he asked me in class today what I felt about it. And I just told him that we know that these things are impossible. And so when some students challenge their professors and say, well, how do you know? They get a reply, which is exactly the same two words, but just said louder. We right. know.
Uh-huh. We know. We just know. And it's ridiculous. And they bluster really, really loudly. And it works and they get away with it because no one ever challenges them. You know, we see it and we've talked about this before. We see it in academia. We see it in archaeology. We see it, certainly in biblical studies. But what you're saying that is so important, I think, is this idea that it's 20% of the material that is uncovered in archaeology is what is actually used, and 80% is never reported upon. I mean, this is scientific gerrymandering. This is saying we're going to take the 20% that fits exactly what we want to say, and we're going to discard the rest. And it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy because we're going to take the 20% that works for us. We're going to create all kinds of scientific papers. We're going to do journal entries. We're going to write books. We're going to put it into the text. And now we've established this as the truth. It's the truth. And that's how they create the truth in science, and in archaeology particularly. But it's actually, you know, when I think about it, it's exactly what happened with the Bible, isn't it? It's exactly what happened at the Council of Nicaea. It's exactly what happened when they said, okay, we have all this material, but you know what? We only want to use these because these tell the story that we want to tell. So from now on, this is what matters and we're going to disregard the rest. I mean, it really, don't you think it's really the same thing?
Oh, absolutely. And there's one extraordinary account, which is the King List of Manetho. There are two big problems with it. One of them is Manetho lists the dynasties of ancient Egypt, roughly from 3000 onwards to the Cleopatra. Well, Cleopatra wasn't around when he wrote it, but basically, you know, afterwards they kept adding to this and the King List, pretty much for 3000 years of its existence, was reliant upon Manetho. So, that is the backbone of dating in ancient Egypt. Now, they have 180-something stellar dates, which basically the ancient Egyptians said on this date, and that star was there, and this is that date. If our Egyptologists were able to use stellar, we would understand what is being said there. If they actually were at some point over the last 100 years of this science, came up with the idea that astronomy might be a good course, and then they might actually begin to address these things and try to find out what these dates really mean, they could come up with a new dating of ancient Egypt. And my dear friend Wim Zitman has precisely done that and has basically said that the origins of ancient Egypt and the dynasties need to be pushed back to roughly 4000 BC based on the dates, which, you know, these hard dates, which are, you know, not debatable. It's just that they haven't been able to explain them. And when he created this, when he went public with his thing, he sent it off to a German professor in, I think, Berlin. And the professor basically said, I greatly admire what you've done. However, not a single Egyptologist will ever accept what you've done. So good luck with that. And we are 5 years since the publication of his book in English. And, you know, guess what? Nobody has even looked at it. However, that is not the problem. The problem is this. Within this timeline, they treat it as set. Now, what happened was a few years ago, almost 20 years ago, there was some carbon dating done on the Great Pyramid. Stones from the Great Pyramid. And these stones were found out to be 500 years older. You know, the classic dating puts the Great Pyramid roughly 2450 BC. And this carbon dating result showed that they were 500 years older, which basically is in line with Wim Zitman's conclusions that, you know, everything needs to be stretched back. You really need to add a thousand years. And so 500 years by that moment in time is kind of like you're getting there. To some extent, this isn't controversial. You know, like 500 years out, who cares? Well, the Egyptological circles have never published these carbon dating results. They have never appeared in an official publication, so everybody can pretend that they don't exist.
Right.
With the late Zahi Hawass, and when I say late, it means because he is gone, and as far as we can tell, he's never going to come back.
But he's not dead, just to be clear. Zahi Hawass has not passed away. He is just no longer controlling the Giza Plateau.
Exactly. What happened there was that he got it into his head that he actually had to approve everything personally before something got published. That is censorship, that is dictatorship. And if there was something which he didn't like and you would steam ahead as an archaeologist, what would happen was that not only you would never be allowed in Egypt to do archaeological digs, but the university you were affiliated with wouldn't either. So it was a deterrent of an extreme thing. However, we're still not coming to the biggest point here. The biggest point is this. Manetho writes a king list, and the king list doesn't start in 3000 BC with 30 dynasties all the way going forward. He also says that before, there is something else happening. And the something else happening are that before the dynasties, before man rules, there is a rule of the Shamsu Hor, the followers of Horus, which are deemed to be some kind of demigods. And before that, there is a period when the gods ruled personally over Egypt, some of them for thousands of years. And some of this stretches back a timeline which goes back 20,000 BC to some extent before. This is the king list of Manetho. Now, if you are ever fortunate or unfortunate to end up in court, either as a spectator or the unfortunate bit as somebody who is confronted with it personally, there's something in legal terms which basically says that a piece of evidence, when it's introduced in court, is a piece of evidence. And you need to accept this piece of evidence, and you can't nitpick. You can't say, well, I like this bit of the evidence, but I don't like that bit of the evidence, so I'm just going to pretend as if the other one doesn't exist. No, a piece of evidence is a piece of evidence, and you, in court, you either throw it out completely or you enter it completely. You can't nitpick. But this is what scientists do, because our Egyptologists adhere completely to Manetho's literal interpretation, that he got it so that right with the dynasties, even though, you know, like there is some error in dates. And wouldn't you accept that there is a few hundred years off left, right, and center over a period of time when somebody is composing these kind of things? However, they're saying that's not the case. And so when you ask them, okay, so you say that Manetho is absolutely right about the dynasties, so he's absolutely right about the gods ruling over Egypt for thousands of years, their answer is, well, no, of course not. I mean, we know that the gods don't exist. These things have never happened. It's just mythological. He just tried to add dates and years to show that Egypt was far older than we know, because they know, remember, they know, Egypt was. You can't do that. You know, you can't do that. It's not scientific. You can't say the guy is an idiot and three lines later that the guy is brilliant. But they get away with it.
Yeah, well, that's what they continue to get away with. And that's the challenge. But, you know, this is the beautiful thing about this show and this book. You know, one of the things that I love is when I hear people say things or ask things like, well, why aren't there any skeptics on Ancient Aliens? You know, why isn't there a counterpoint? And my thing is, because it's taken us, you know, 20 years to finally get a show that allows real expression of these ideas without the skeptics always having the last word. I mean, that has always been the point of view of the media, especially in America, that you always do point counterpoint. You would present this and then the skeptics always had the last word. Whether it's a USA Today article or a documentary on the History Channel or National Geographic, it was always, here's our point, and then here's a skeptic rubbishing it and telling you all the reasons why it can't be true. Oh, well, it was fun for a minute. Have a nice day. You know, what I love about what's happening now is that we are seeing a new trend, and the new trend is toward an open-mindedness that is allowing these ideas to have real expression without giving the academics their due. And I think they're actually really pissed off about it.
Well, I mean, and my point is always, well, there are TV shows where, you know, Zahi Hawass or Mark Lehner, who's a very prominent American Egyptologist, do it from A to Z. Why are the Andrew Collinses, myself, the Davidoviches, not on their show, giving a counter argument to them? Somehow we are, you know, again, rationalizing certain things by saying they should have a part in controversial material, but in to some extent, the skeptics, you know, to some extent, we are skeptical about the historical timeline which is being presented. We're saying that we don't buy that one. We're skeptical about that. We don't get airtime on their shows. So why should they get airtime, on, you know, our shows? But I think this tit for tatting, it is so boring. You know what you're going to say. You just know. You know. We know. So you don't have to get them on the show. And also there is no, it cuts in this debate, for a very long period of time. I think people felt, media executives felt that controversy sold, that it was good to have an argument, on TV. But basically it's not an argument, because argument A, you know, is done in a TV studio somewhere, and the opposition is in another TV studio, and never the two shall cross. So it isn't really an argument. It's just somebody saying whatever the other guy said, I'm saying it's not.
Well, and I think it's not even about the argument. I think sometimes with the media, particularly the print media, it's about being afraid to give air to a controversial theory because it looks like they haven't done their due diligence. You know, it's like, well, we have to give the skeptics the last word. Otherwise, it looks like we're not being responsible in what we're reporting, which when you consider the state of the media right now is pretty funny and a little bit ironic. But I certainly saw this when The Expected One came out. I mean, every interview with me closed with either Marvin Meyer or Bart Ehrman saying, well, you know, there's no proof of any of these things. And it drove me completely insane because to my knowledge, Bart Ehrman and Marvin Meyer have not done a fraction, if any, of the research I have done on this subject. You know, they're tenured and they have their teaching positions in their universities and they have their books. But you know what? They are not in the field in the south of France for years studying the traditions of the people there, which is what my books are about. So you know what? I don't think they have the right to say that there's no proof of anything that I have written about because they haven't been there. Once they've gone to the Languedoc and spent several years down there, then they can come back and they can rubbish my, you know, findings. And I think that this is the case with the ancient alien stuff too. You've got a lot of these archaeologists who are just going to say, it's rubbish, it's crap, don't even talk to me about it. I don't want my students, I'm going to fail my students if they even mention ancient aliens in my class, that kind of stuff. But they actually don't have the right to rubbish your research because they have not been to the places you have been.
And, you know, it's very easy to say, you know, well, there is no evidence for this. And one of the things which I go into my book is something which is as scientific as it can get. It's the science of astrobiology. And in the third season of Ancient Aliens, he was interviewed for Ancient Epidemics, Alien Epidemics, and or Plagues, or whatever the title of that specific show was called. But it's Chandra Wickramasinghe. He is a icon of the science of astrobiology. He has shown that certain things like the Black Plague and various other things more than likely have an extraterrestrial component, that viruses come from outer space. Because basically what happened was that some of these viruses spread across the world faster than humans were traveling across the world. So it couldn't be human agent, it couldn't be birds or anything like that. Something was clearly being seeded on the planet, across the planet, at the same time. And so he has done research into that, and his background is a theory of panspermia. This question whether or not, life comes from outside of the Earth. And here's some things. Louis Pasteur, in the middle of the 19th century, basically said that this idea that some primordial soup gave rise to life on planet Earth should be completely discarded because anorganic material had never led to organic material. It had never been shown. And he basically said to those who adhere to this, if you want to disprove me, you know, show me an example of where this happens. But everything which has been researched for, you know, so far has just shown that this is not the case. And this is something which everybody, when you press them, they will accept, but you need to get them out there. You need to have this ammunition to throw at them before they will back down. And so it's once again up to somebody to put scientists with their back against the wall before they are going to say this. Now, that again is not the core of the problem. Chandra Wickramasinghe has gone on the record to say that every single report, every single journal which he has or essay which he has written with findings about the fact that life does not come from this planet has been boycotted since 1982 by all scientific publications on the topic. Not just him, but every other astrobiologist, including an extraordinary amount of those people who work for NASA. NASA scientists are unable to get their material published in peer-reviewed journals. So what has science, what is NASA doing? They basically know they're not going to get published. So they do science by press release. They basically say, here's a report which we did. You know, they hold, if it's important enough, they hold a press conference. If it's not important enough, it's just a press release from NASA because NASA knows they will not get published. Last year in December of 2010, there was an extraordinary case whereby a woman, Felicia Wolf-Simon, found in Mono Lake, California, signs of life which defied everything which we know about life on this planet. It upset the science of origins of life beyond anything. And she published, got, you know, like several people, several leading astrobiologists to co-sign off on her findings. She knew full well that this was as far as it was going to go. So it is peer-reviewed. It's just not published by these journals because these journals don't publish it. And blogs and everybody from the traditional group of people who do sit on these peer reviews for these journals, they went after her. And they came up with a conspiracy theory, which is that NASA is involved in an unscientific campaign to convince the world that there is life out there. Yet that there is no evidence whatsoever that, you know, there is life out there. And as evidence for the fact that they say that there is no evidence for this whatsoever is the fact that they say that none of these things have ever appeared in peer-reviewed journals. Isn't that ironic?
Yeah. No, it is. It's more than ironic. It's criminal. It really is because it's, you know, it's... It really is keeping so much information, extraordinary, exquisite, exciting information away from the people. I mean, it really feels to me like it's a massive cover-up. I mean, I hate to sound conspiratorial, but, you know, and I don't think that it's a conspiracy and that there's a, you know, a group of men sitting in a room somewhere saying, let's not tell anybody. I think it's a conspiracy of ego. It's a conspiracy of protecting tenure. I mean, is that what you think it is? Or is it something, is it more fear-based? What do you think is the reason for all of this?
To some extent, it does have to do with ego. It also has to do with the fact that science is so insular. You know, the joke I'm kind of like making is that you have one scientist who's studying the west side of the Great Pyramid and another scientist who's studying the east side of the Great Pyramid. And never will they compare notes. They will publish separately. And when somebody says to them, so your colleague there was on the other side. So how does your research compare to his? They will kind of like say like, oh, we don't know. We don't really care. We were studying the west side of the Great Pyramid, so that is our area of expertise. And it is extraordinary that this is what happens, but it happens, you know, not to this extent. But the Nazca lines, for example, you have people who have done excavations on the human remains, who've done excavations on the pyramids there, and who've done studies on the geoglyphs there. Don't think for a second that there is one who's done research on all three of them.
Okay, so let's look at this for a minute, because one of the things I think is fantastic about this book, and fun and controversial, is that at the same time that you defend a lot of these theories, and you are very strong in your position that we need to be open to all of this other material, there is also the side of you that is not necessarily a skeptic, but very big at getting to the truth. You are not, you know, I think it would surprise some people who haven't read this book yet to know that you don't accept a lot of the ancient alien theories across the board just because. You know, we always joke that the believers think you're a skeptic and the skeptic thinks you're a believer, and that, you know, you really hold the middle ground in that you're more, you know, your concern is about getting to the truth rather than saying, oh, I'm a believer or, oh, I'm a skeptic. But you do have some elements in this book where you shatter a couple of iconic ideas. And I think that that is going to be surprising and also controversial. And we've already seen it be controversial, personally and privately so far, in terms of some of the material that would be beloved of the fans of Zechariah Sitchin, for example. So I was wondering if you'd like to talk about that, the Sitchin controversy, where you go with it in this book, and why it will be considered potentially controversial.
Yes, I mean, I look at the big ancient alien theories, people who say that they hold the absolute truth. And I couldn't go to everybody, but the big ones, the most famous ones are out there are David Icke, William Bramley, and Zechariah Sitchin. And David Icke largely gets all of his stuff from the other two, from Bramley, Sitchin, plus a Sitchin aficionado called René-André Boulet, who carried on the work of Sitchin and made these creatures from Sumerian mythology into reptilians, which obviously took the fancy of David Icke. Now, when it comes to Sitchin, you will notice that, okay, he was old, but he never was, and I will say rolled out, but in a respectful way, in front of the camera to have his say. Within the ancient alien research community, he was known as a person who really didn't get it right, who had extremely stubborn opinions about certain things, but when challenged about them, would never address them. He was also a guy who wanted to sue you for whatever, on a personal, not experience level, but a personal story which I know of somebody. Basically, somebody once did a translated edition of Sitchin, got his permission from his publishers and all of that. Several years later, Sitchin found out about it, threatened him with lawyers. The publisher said, well, I have all the paperwork. And Sitchin defense was kind of like, well, I don't remember that. It's like, well, you know, memory isn't something which is a legal argument for suing people. It would be all too easy. But I mean, you know, coming to the core of the problem is this. Sitchin's theory, is unfortunately for him, a theory which if you take one leg from the table, the table collapses. Not necessarily, some theories don't work like that, but Sitchin's does. And so what Sitchin says is this. He says, in the 1960s and 70s, I was a person who could correctly translate Sumerian inscriptions and Sumerian words, whereas everybody else wasn't able to do this. Everybody else got it wrong. I got it right. And this is what I got. And so he goes on to explain that the ancient Sumerians basically relate a story about how their ancestors, the gods, came down in spaceships. And he says, like, you know, the word mu equals spaceship, sham equals spaceship. Well, when people, some of them scientists, but some of them just interested as well, basically confronted him with that, and they said, like, well, there is a lexicon of ancient Babylon, of ancient Sumerian words, which we still have. They're inscribed on walls of temples, and afterwards in books. So we know what the ancient Sumerians, believed. And in their lexicon, mu, shem doesn't equal spaceship. So what is your answer to that? He just never replied. For 8 years, he didn't reply. And it's a basic problem. You know, it's not a translation issue. It's the fact that the Sumerians themselves had a definition for these words, and the definition for the word was not spaceship. Now, to some extent, you know, you can say, okay, but what really upset me and infuriated me, was the following thing. Sitchin doesn't do much footnoting, and to some extent, you know, fair enough. However, there is in his more recent books, one of the best evidences, there's a chapter in my book called The Best Evidence, and one of the best evidences is something which Sitchin discusses, and to some extent had made famous, which is this glass-like substance in the Sinai Desert. And for the glass to have been created there, it basically had to have been exposed to extremely high, temperatures. So Sitchin had said basically that there had been an atomic bomb dropped by space people in a war of the pyramids and the like, and that the glass in the Sinai Desert was a result of this atomic explosion which had happened there. And obviously when it comes to best evidence, glass-like substances like that talk about an atomic explosion clearly suggests that, you know, something is going on. So I was looking at that, all of that evidence, to find out whether it stood up to scrutiny. Independent of kind of, you know, looking at his own theories to do with the Sumerians. So in one of his more recent books, he actually says, as it just so happens, a scientific publication appeared which completely substantiates my theory about these, my findings about this glass. And it also shows, has shown that in his, after looking into everything, that he has no explanation as to why this glass came about. So when we have done away with all the normal things, what remains is my extraordinary thesis, basically that this is evidence of an atomic warfare. And I thought, wow, that's pretty cool. So in this case, he hadn't really listed the source too closely, but he'd given enough for me to do a Google search, and I was able to find the report he was referring to. And fortunately, once again, it was very easily available on the internet as a PDF copy, if I remember correctly. I downloaded it and I began to read it. And to my utter surprise, even the abstract, gives a completely different view. So Sitchin is saying that this scientist has no idea how this glass came about. Well, what the abstract says, is that the scientist has looked at all these pieces, and he has clearly identified that the glass comes from a volcanic eruption, and that this volcanic eruption, you know, that the only problem he has is that there are three candidates, and he has so far been unable to pinpoint precisely which of the three was responsible for the glass. Now, Sitchin, when you go back to Sitchin, you actually see that he's using pretty much the wording from this abstract, in the way he's relating the account as to how, you know, the scientist allegedly has vindicated him. So, in my opinion, Sitchin could not have failed to see that the scientist was saying that it was about volcanic material, that the volcano was responsible for it. And in my opinion, he purposely basically did away with that and molded this scientific study in a way he wanted it, because he felt that he was in need of basically falsifying it so that it would fit his preconceived notions as to what the Cine glass was all about. You know, the fact that he might not have been able to see this, to me stretches the imagination a bit, because again, it's in the abstract and he's pretty much paraphrasing the abstract, to some extent quoting the abstract without putting the quotation marks in. So it made me lose all respect for Sitchin. The little I had left after kind of, you know, not addressing basic points where people ask nicely. You know, people were asking nicely as to why he felt Shem and Mu equaled spaceship, whereas the lexicons were saying that this didn't equal it. So I'm afraid that, you know, he has done a tremendous disservice to the ancient astronaut field. It's one of the reasons why his material is hardly ever discussed on Ancient Aliens. But, you know, he has a large sway out there, and specifically in conspiracy circles, because his material made its way, you know, with the David Icke's and various sort of conspiracy theorists, all of this stuff about the Anunnaki and the Illuminati controlling the world governments, and how Obama is, you know, not in charge, but that there is a power elite behind him, and that power elite are like the handlers for the aliens on this planet. It's something which lives there with an awful lot of you know, conspiracy minded people out there.
Yes.
And it's unfortunately, you know, something which I hate, because the reason why I hate it is this. It depicts E.T. as this alien overlord who is here to suppress and oppress us, who never had anything good to do with us. We were genetically created to work in the mines, you know, and then somehow we either won our independence, or they just kind of like said, like, oh, we can't care about those humans anyway anymore. Let them just do for a little while whatever they want to do, and we'll come back to them if they get too much out of hand. That's the kind of image those conspiracy theories paint. All the evidence of, you know, everything which I have studied and so many other people have studied shows the ancient alien hand as benign, guiding us in civilization, helping us along with civilization, to an extent telling us these are methods through which you can experience the divine, through which you can experience God with a big G. And that is so different from what these big encompassing Sitchin-esque theories are proposing, which is that E.T. was bad. All the evidence suggests E.T. was benevolent and helped us, and, you know, was here to help us along if we so wanted to use their information.
Well, I'm a firm believer that fundamentalism in anything, whether it's any kind of belief system, either religion or philosophy, is a bad thing. And we find with a lot of the Sitchin fans that there is a extremism, a fundamentalism. You are not allowed to attack Sitchin's theories under any circumstances, and they can get quite ugly about it. And so if you're listening to this and you're a Sitchin fan, I think that there's much to be fascinated with in Sitchin's material, but I think that opening your mind and looking at the places where he might have been flawed or wrong is only going to benefit your own progress in terms of understanding some of these theories. I mean, I have seen some of the personal attacks that you have received from Sitchin fans who just flat out will not accept anyone questioning Sitchin's material. I mean, we've even had a letter from someone who said, how dare you question his material because the man is dead? How dare you question the material of a dead man? Which, I'm sorry, but I think it was hilarious.
Yes, I didn't kill him. He died of old age. Like, you know, if I'd killed him just so that I could kind of like, you know, slaughter his name afterwards, you know, if this book came out when he was still alive, I would have said exactly the same thing. It just so happens that he died, you know.
You know, but all, but this idea that we now because someone has passed away, we have to accept anything they said, you know, as hallowed ground. You know, let's face it, it's a little bit ridiculous. And, you know, I just want to throw in another personal Sitchin story. And that is that, I actually met him in Egypt, in 1992 in January, at this big 11/11 thing that happened on the Giza Plateau. And I did not have a tremendous amount of interaction with him, so I can't say that I had, you know, a lot of, you know, personal interaction with him. But I found him fascinating, absolutely. But I do want to say that one of the reasons you don't see Sitchin on these shows, not just Ancient Aliens, but others, was that he was particularly difficult, with television producers who wanted to get his material out there. You know, we are aware of at least one producer who tried to work with him, and the amount of rules that he presented before he would allow any of his material to be aired were just completely impossible to deal with. You know, you were not allowed to edit him under any circumstances. If he wanted to give a 30-minute answer, you had to allow him to give a 30-minute answer. So it almost seemed to me like he intentionally made it difficult for people to get his material out there. And it's something that I never really understood, if it was because he was, you know, a difficult personality, or if he had real fear of what was going to happen if his material went on the air and it was edited incorrectly, or in some way to make him look bad. I don't know, because I was not in the man's head. I don't know what it was about him, but I will say that there were a lot of people who tried to give him the opportunity to be seen more on television and to present more of his theories, and he wasn't interested. And he also did not want to answer questions. That was the other thing. He wanted to talk, but he was not interested in asking questions. So I think that one of the things with him was he might have been afraid that people were going to ask him these questions, which for so many years he just flat out refused to answer.
Yes, I mean, there's one funny incident several years ago. I think it's almost 20 years ago, when he was at a conference and he was in a question and answer session, and pretty much the session was all for himself. And so there were questions coming from the audience, and sometimes he would go back to the moderator and kind of say like, "Nope, not answering that one," which is kind of like defeating the purpose of a question and answering session. He should have just said, "You know, I'm not going to do it. I'm just going to give a lecture." But yes, he was a notoriously difficult man. You know, that's not a secret for everybody who met him, or tried to work with him. And, you know, he was a guy who I think had a bee in his bonnet, who came up with a big theory, but which, you know, basically has been exposed as being erroneous. You know, do I have respect for him? To some extent, I would have said that up until I found out what he did with that scientific report, that I had some respect for him. But when, you know, you find out that he purposely misleads his readers, into thinking that a scientific report supports his conclusions, I basically lost all respect for him.
So looking at everything that's going on with this book right now, and in its release, it was already in the top 15 at Amazon in the New Age section, which is very exciting, and it's gaining momentum. So we're thrilled about that. But what would you say, what do you want people to take away from this book? I mean, you've got, and I think that it appeals to a wide audience. It's not just the Ancient Alien audience. I think it's anyone who's curious about opening their mind at this space and time in the 21st century. What is the one thing that you really want people to take away from this book?
Basically, you know, it is written for everybody. There's new, if you've read everything about Ancient Aliens or you've watched the entire show five times over, you will still find new material in there. Some of it is you know, specific for this book. But what I want to get people away from is that when you look at all the evidence combined, what you get is the sense that, yes, we seem to have been contacted in the past. And the reason why I use the word seem is that I'm also telling people, you know, the burden of proof is something which, you know, it can be moved. I see this in interviews. One of the things when they say, okay, what's the best evidence? And I quite often say, well, it's the one because it's a historical account of the ancient Babylonians who say that they met a half fish, half man creature who taught them about the sciences. And then some of them will kind of say, well, how do you know this isn't a visitor from the future who traveled back in time and gave this information to our ancestors? And it's like, okay, you just made that up. You're now creating a theory which you got to prove. You got to prove that Uranus came from the future. So if you want to have that, that's fine. But at this moment in time, you're the one coming up with the theory. I've just pointed out to you that this is the best available evidence of a creature which was clearly non-human. Who said he came from somewhere else. And we get this, throughout. So, if you want to, you can continue to deny it. You can continue to try and explain it away. But if you are, level-minded and, open to this idea, then you will walk away with material which says that we were not alone. And that there are also clues and opportunities for science to go forward in time, and take these things on. At the end of the day, in the last 40,000 years, ET will only have come here 2, 3, maybe 4 times, not more. So when you list 14 to 15 best evidence cases, by default, 10 will likely end up as not being evidence of ET. That doesn't necessarily mean it's not important. You'll probably find that those cases show that our ancestors were more technologically aware and more intelligent than we give them credit for. But it will not lead to, or likely lead to an answer that ET had been here. But, there is very much evidence that it suggests that we were not alone. And the big thing is this. Some of it is archaeological, some of it is historical. But when people, say that the gods were present, like, for example, Viracocha in the Inca Empire, the god walked through the sacred valley. And it is specifically in that sacred valley that you have sites like Sacsayhuaman, Cusco, and Pumapunku. Then you're beginning to say, this is interesting, because Pumapunku is not found in Corral where there were pyramids. The anomalous, objects which defy the Incas themselves are found in precisely the places where they said their gods physically walked through. And that is something, where archaeology and archaeological remains and historical and to some extent anthropological material all combined to point to the same conclusion, which is that we're confronted here with something which definitely our ancestors believed was absolutely the case. And if we ever as a society, as a civilization, would be interested enough to go there and try to find the answer, then we too would come to that conclusion that we were not alone.
And so, therefore, the answer to the ancient alien question is yes.
It is yes, but also, as I am pointing out, the book is called The Ancient Alien Question and not The Ancient Alien Answer. And the reason why it is a question is because as a society, we have not gone down that path. We have allowed archaeologists to get away with not addressing some of these questions. We have given, to some extent, geneticists free rein into not going there and trying to find out whether or not there is some kind of extraterrestrial or non-human component to our DNA. So it remains a question until we really answer it, but all the indications are absolutely there that the answer is yes.
And the answer now is that we have come to the end of our hour on this week's edition of the Spirit Revolution, correct?
Absolutely. That answer is yes as well.
You've been a fantastic guest, Mr. Coppins.
I hope you have me on in the future again, and maybe I might even co-host some of these shows with you.
Hey, can you do that next week?
Yes.
Okay. You'll see us back here next week as you always do. And for those of you who want to hear other episodes, or this edition of the Spirit Revolution, what can they do?
They can go to the BBS Radio Archives, where they will read, be able to get this show, as well as everything else, which is on the BBS, radio station. A small fee will apply for that. They can go to iTunes, where they can get pretty much a year and a half worth of our shows for free, the downloads. They can go to our own website called thespiritrevolution.com, where the 5 latest shows are always available for listening and for download. And from this week on, we are also posting links to our shows from within the Facebook page of The Spirit Revolution, which is facebook.com/spiritrevolution. So basically, you can get to our show any means possible.
And I just want to say to all of our listeners, particular our regulars who know us so well and have been really faithful to this show, we're coming up on our 2-year anniversary, which is an amazing thing to me for the show. Philip and I are not sitting next to each other on the couch doing this interview. Philip is actually in Scotland and I am in Los Angeles. So, you know, just so you know, we are actually conducting a real interview for this.
Absolutely. Which brings us to that catchphrase, as you were quoting on your Facebook page, I said, truth is, whether you choose to believe it or not, but we have our own catchphrase for this show.
The truth against the world.